In the year 2006, filmmaker Les Blank and tea merchant and artist David Hoffman were guests on Mouthful, talking about their work in progress, All in This Tea, one of the films featured in last year's Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival. In honor of this year's festival, which concludes this evening, we're airing the archive of that show. We'd like to wish congratulations to everyone involved in the festival. Here, then, is that archival broadcast.
From KRCB in Santa Rosa, it's Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour with Michelle Anna Jordan.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be ready to do.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of water. You fry some garlic. And you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious. Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Jordan. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you enjoy the show. I know I'm going to. Sometimes I wish this were TV because the array of wonderful things we have in the studio at times is visually breathtaking as well as good to listen to. Tonight the subject is tea, but before we welcome our primary tea guest, we're going to welcome an old friend of Mouthful's, Les Blank. This is your second or third visit to Mouthful. It's so great of you to come back.
My pleasure.
And I know that you're working on, you have a film in progress about tea, which we'll be talking about for most of the hour. But I had the occasion, thanks to you for loaning me those DVDs, to watch three of your films just a couple days ago. I watched Yum, 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 Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe, and Garlic is as Good as 10 Mothers. And I have to say, I'm always dazzled by sort of this simple immediacy that sort of describes how you capture people, just in the act of being good, lusty humans who like to live life. So it's a real pleasure. And after watching it, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I want to talk just a little bit about Yum, 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 which takes place outside of New Orleans, not in New Orleans. It's out in the country, right?
Yes, it's in the southwest part of Louisiana. It's about 160 miles from New Orleans.
Okay, and you're getting you have people who are out in the woods cooking food in a big pot. I mean, that's part of it. How did you hook up with these people?
Well, when I went down there in search of people for my first film on Cajuns, I met Marc Savoy, and he's been a friend ever since. So 20 years after making Spend It All, I went back and was helping Chris Strachwitz, who has a company called Arhuli Records and Down Home Music. There is a store in El Cerrito that sells the best kind of roots music you can find anywhere in the world.
It's a great store.
So he wanted me to help him do a definitive film on Cajun and Zydeco music. So I had done one on Cajun, Spend It All, and I'd done a couple on Creole or Zydeco, the more African-influenced side of the coin. And he wanted to combine them all and do a complete history. So I was helping him shoot the music film. And while I was there, I decided to do a film on just the food, Cajun and Creole food.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that it seems you're seeing during that film is they're actually cooking things on the spot that they are going to eat. It looks, I mean, you can practically smell the aromas coming off the screen. And is that the case? It was like they were just really cooking right then, weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Making their lunch.
They were making their lunch. Oh, it was so good. We're going to hear a little sample from Yum Yum Yum.
Entertainment. We always looked at eating as part of our celebration. There was always one great cook in the neighborhood, and I'm talking about maybe five or six families was a neighborhood, because you lived a mile or two apart. And there was somebody who would cook, and the somebody in our neighborhood was my mother, and there was always somebody who could play the fiddle or somebody who could play the accordion, and we'd all get together at the house and cook and move furniture and dance and raise hell and have a good time.
That's just a little bit of what you get. And I should tell you, all of your films, or most of your films, are available. If you go to the website, you can purchase them on VHS, and you can purchase now quite a number of them on DVD, right?
Yeah, all the main films are now on DVD at lesblank.com.
And these are the sort of films I think you want to own. I own several, and I plan on owning more. And we're going to hear more samples from the three movies I recently watched throughout the evening. But I want to introduce David Lee Hoffman. Welcome to Mouthful. I'm so happy to finally have you here. I met you, it was at Enceladas a number of years ago when you still had Silk Road Tea and you were actually there with Les, and I was there for dinner and just happened to recognize you. And probably there's no reason you should remember, but I've been wanting to get you on the air ever since I tasted some of your teas. And now to provide context, Les, you're working on a film about tea. The tea film is the working title, or so it says on your website, that you're doing with David, right?
Yeah, what's that? Really a film about David, and it so happens that when Gina Liebrecht, who came along as initially my assistant and then my editor, and now she's my co-producer and co-director of the film, she more or less isolated out the tea side of David, and that's going to be the tea film.
Oh.
I'm going to continue shooting him and filming all the other interesting things he does, which we can do another time perhaps.
Just so we don't leave everyone really curious, can you name what some of those other things are before we start on tea?
Well, there's the Grand Pissoir and the Petit Pissoir. These are major architectural wonders that there's never been anything quite like it. These are built from hand-cut granite blocks brought back from China. Long ago, he discovered that you can bring back a container full of granite blocks for the same price as a container full of tea. So as he was bringing back containers of tea, he brought back all these blocks. He's now got something like a pyramid-sized outhouse that consumes feces and urine and wastes no water. By the time it goes through these various circulating pools fed by gravity, it's eaten by fishes and plants and ends up being perfectly safe, healthy plant food. So if more people did this, there would be no wasting of water. There would be no need for a chemical fertilizer to feed our plants. So you kill two birds with one stone. Two major ecological concerns at this time.
Interesting. Wow.
Plus he's an artist. He's doing that. Making it into a work of art.
Mm-hmm. Well, on topic for another time. Sounds like something one really wants to see. But you started Silk Road Teas a number of years ago.
Yes.
And now you've sold Silk Road Teas.
Yes.
And you've specialized in a certain type of tea. And I have to tell you, it's almost 2 years to the date that I first tried Pu'er tea. And it was on this show. And it was a revelation. It was one of those small revelations that changes your life. So I want you to talk about your involvement with Pu'er tea and really tell us what it is.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, before we start, how did you first hear about Pu'er tea?
I did a tea show, and I had a woman named Mickey who has infusions in Sebastopol, and also a gentleman whose name I'm not going to remember right now, from a tea shop in San Francisco. And they were both making various types of tea, and he poured this cup of something, and it looked like very dark coffee. Mm. And I tasted it, and it was just with that taste, I was like, my goodness, this is one of the most delicious, compelling things I'd ever tasted. It was so counterintuitive, because when you see something that dark, you sort of expect astringency, tannin on the palate, and it was like velvet.
Hmm.
And I went out and bought some, and I drank it every morning. So you have pu'er teas, though, that I've never seen. You have a huge variety. So why don't you talk a little bit about what got you so interested in it?
Well, I suppose it goes back almost 30 years. Let's see, 1966, I had my first cup of pu'er. I was traveling outside of the country for 10 years, and in the course of my travels, I ended up living and traveling with Tibetan nomads, and they really introduced me to pu'er teas. Of course, they weren't calling them pu'er in those days. They were just, it was just the tea they drank. And it so happens that this tea has been around for thousands of years. In fact, Tibet is the oldest country outside of China that's a tea-drinking country. When we think of tea, we think of the major producers such as India and Ceylon or Sri Lanka. But these are countries that are relatively new to the tea world. They only started up in the mid-19th century, whereas countries like Tibet, although they never grew tea there, it was a main part of their daily diet and routine. So they were there's actually written records of the Tibetans drinking teas back in the 6th century. So I got my start with pu'ers really with the Tibetan nomads.
Mm-hmm. So you said that 30 years ago they weren't called pu'er yet.
They just called it tea.
Tea, Was that name pu'er used in China?
It's used in China, but only in the north, in Putonghua or Mandarin. They use the word pu'er. The Cantonese, of which are very passionate about pu'er drinkers. If you go to any dim sum restaurant, they will typically serve pu'er teas with dim sum. But they don't call it by the Mandarin word pu'er. They call it bole or pone, or bole is usually how they pronounce it. But they have nine different tonal inflections, so my pronunciation by the Chinese isn't real good.
So how did you start? You've now been importing it. And actually, you know what? I'm going to back up, erase everything I just said. What is pu'er? What makes a tea pu'er? Is it the camellia bush?
It's from the camellia. Well, it's some people call it camellia assamica. It's really the same as the camellia sinensis. The assamica is a large leaf varietal of the camellia tree. And in Yunnan province, where the pu'ers originated, you could still find these trees growing there, some as old as 1,700 years. And they're still producing leaf that could be made into pu'er tea. Now, pu'er gets its name from a pretty insignificant little town in Yunnan province, but it used to be an historical trade center. And all the teas coming out of Yunnan eventually passed through the town of pu'er and then was retransported to the various parts of mostly Asia. Some made their way back to Europe via the northern route through the Gobi Desert and through Siberia. Pu'er is basically a tea that is, well, I should say if you asked 100 experts on what a pu'er is, you'd probably get 100 different answers.
Oh, okay.
It's quite complex. It's more of a group of teas, and it's easy to say that they are teas that can be aged and improved with age. So people will actually buy pu'er teas just to put away for the aging process. And their value goes up with time, much like many wines will improve with age. So do the pu'er teas.
Now, if they're the same plant, what special quality is there about these particular teas that allow them to improve with age?
It used to be a state secret, and
really?
They said, I mean, you could literally get arrested by disclosing how pu'er teas are made. And there's still a lot of misinformation being passed around. But the main thing to consider when you describe Puertese is that they are they're inoculated with a natural bacteria. And in the presence of moisture and a little bit of heat, they become very active. And if you heap up the tea during this process, the tea itself will heat up much like a compost pile. And they stop this process before it becomes too radically different in taste. How should I put it? The tea is stopped at the right moment, mm-hmm. and then the enzyme activity is arrested by drying the tea out and applying some heat. But there's a certain amount of biological activity left in the tea leaf. So once the tea is stored, it will continue to slowly oxidize over many years. So a tea that starts out green, maybe after 20 years, will be quite dark in appearance. Mm-hmm. And
what's the natural bacteria?
I have a name of that. There's been a lot of tea scientists written down, but I can't recall it offhand. It's in my notes.
Is that something like a starter for a good sourdough?
Well, it is, and for many years people thought that they actually inoculated the tea leaf with this starter or bacteria. And it's actually a combination of bacteria and yeast. And this bacteria is only found in the pu'er teas, which is interesting. Or I should say only found in tea. And it compromises about 50% of all the bacteria found in tea. Half of that is restricted to this one type of bacteria. But yeast itself plays a big role in the aging of tea.
That's so interesting. When you see pu'er in stores, as you're starting to see, and in some restaurants in Northern California, you see it one of two ways, as a leaf or pressed into some sort of form that you have to break apart. Mm. What is most traditional?
The traditional way was pressed tea, only so much as in the transportation of this tea, you could easily transport compressed bricks, and it survived the weather well. So if the tea should get rained on or get caught in a dust storm or whatever, the tea will not be affected by this. You could easily clean it off and continue on with your journey. Whereas if you had a big sacks of loose leaf tea, for one, they'd occupy a huge amount of space. And if you tried to transport 100 kilos of tea loose leaf on the camel's back, you'd have a huge amount of area that would blow the poor camel off the trails in a big windstorm, whereas 100 kilos of compressed tea will easily fit into two compact trunks that could ride on the sides of a camel.
Okay, so it's practicality. And is it true, you're starting to see stuff about pu'er tea, both online and in a few books, and you see that it was often buried in the ground. Is that true? Is that one of the things that happens with it?
That was one of the methods of aging the tea, but I think it had to do more with tea was a valuable commodity, and much like gold or silver, people used tea for bartering goods. And some of the bricks of tea actually had score marks on the back, so you could cut the bricks into different sections and use this for your bartering.
Different denominations of
different
tea.
Different denominations. If you like.
Well, you've brought a lot of tea, so why don't we take a little musical interlude and you can bring some over to talk about them specifically and maybe even make a cup or two that we can try?
Sure.
You go on the bus on the road through the green fields of pleasure. Cattle stand in the grazing land and the sheep running through the heather. Why not?
You are listening to Mouthful here on KRCB. I'm Michelle Jordan. Thanks for sticking with us. My guest this evening, documentary filmmaker Les Blank, and purveyor of puer tea, David Lee Hoffman. And we're getting ready to make some puer. So why don't you talk to us about what we're going to try?
Yeah, well, I have over 300 kinds of puers, and that's part of the fun with puers is there's so much variety and distinctive characteristics amongst the puers. So I would encourage anyone who has tried a puer and has perhaps made a judgment on that to keep trying, because it's easy to find a puer that maybe you don't care for in your taste, but it's also easy to find one that's very exciting and more user-friendly. The thing about puer is it's certainly not a tea for everyone, because it is an aged tea. It has many characteristics that our palate is just not used to tasting.
What sort of characteristics would you say?
Well, it can be very earthy. It can be astringent. If you take a fresh green puer and you make it too strong, it's really not very palatable. But if you take that same tea and steep it for a very short time, it could be very delicious. So it's not as forgiving in the steeping process as, say, a fully oxidized puer.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to how you drink them, my limited experience with puer is you drink it neat, no milk, no sugar. What is that traditional?
It is in China, but if you were Tibetan, you would boil the tea up with salt and add rancid butter to it. They usually call it yak butter, but yak actually is the male animal. The dri or the drimo is the female yak.
So is that the Tibetan salt tea we hear about?
Oh, yeah.
Is made with puer. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And the real passionate Tibetan tea drinkers love the really old puer, the aged ones, the ones that have been kicking around for a long time.
Well, why don't you go ahead and get some water and pour? And Les, I'm going to ask you, when you got to the part about tea in your filming of David, were you much of a tea drinker at that point?
Not really.
Are you now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
About 8 cups every morning.
That's more than me. What was it that you liked about it? I mean, if that's a quantifiable thing, something we can say.
Well, it has a slow curve in waking me up, and it carries me into a state of mind I find pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like coffee, which is sort of suddenly you're shot out of the gate and you're nerves start jangling, and mm-hmm. And the taste of coffee, after you had a few sips of coffee, it's just kind of a bitter stuff on the back of your throat. But I like coffee. I'll drink it after dinner mm-hmm. sometimes if I'm going out to dinner. But tea is something, I drink several kinds. Every morning I have a different kind. And I read the newspaper and think about things and watch the birds in the feeder. And I spend almost 2 hours during this tea consumption every morning.
Really?
Yeah.
And what are some of the different types that you enjoy?
Oh, the Golden Needle, Golden Monkey. These are names I think he gave to the tea. Some of them, were they named that before? Those names?
Well, some of the names are traditional and some are difficult to translate, so we try and give a close name or a representative name of the tea.
Mm-hmm. And you have such an amazing display just here, and this is a fraction. How do you find these teas?
Physically, how do I go out?
Yeah, like how do you go out and access these teas? I mean, I know you don't go to your local wholesaler.
No, that's been the challenge. When I first started going to Yunnan province, that's the homeland of puer teas, this was back in 92, and the tea districts were highly restricted in those days. I could not physically get into a lot of the famous old tea mountains there.
Really? And you stopped by the government policy? You just weren't allowed?
Yeah, stopped by the police or by soldiers or, you know, it was highly restricted to go into these areas. but I persisted, and eventually I was welcomed to these areas. Once they saw I was buying tea and an asset to the tea farmers, they gave me more freedom of movement there. So I was able to penetrate a lot of the highly restricted areas and go off into the mountains and collect these teas. So, Michelle, I've got three teas that I made up here. These are green pu'er teas. And what I did is I steeped them in what in China they call these the brew cups, the gaiwan or gaibei or chung. They have different names. They're simply a lidded cup with a lid, and they're a very convenient way to steep teas. Now, what I've done is I rinsed off all the teas, which is typical for pu'er. Usually you rinse them before you steep them.
And you do that with hot water.
With hot water. And what I've done here is taken three green pu'ers and rinsed them off, and I'm going to pass them to you and let you describe what you feel the aroma is of all three of these.
Okay. So we're going to start with the first one. I'll tell you, I know very little about green pu'er tea. I haven't really had any experience.
Not a prerequisite.
Mm. This one starts out sort of toasty almost, and almost with a toasted rice aroma. And then something green, not quite spinach, but something. Oh, it's almost like being in the rainforest in Hawaii, that sort of damp green aroma that you get when it's very wet but very warm.
I like that.
So I don't know how I did with that. Okay, this is the second one. Now, this one's very different. It smells, it doesn't smell green at all. It smells golden and warm. And there's an almost not quite caramelized aroma, like caramelized sugar or caramelized honey to it that I haven't smelled before. And it does have a sort of golden, almost a golden sheen to it. And it has more of an aroma of tea that, like English tea with milk and sugar. Mm. There's a quality in the aroma that there. And then the third one. The third one has a bit of that almost briny, almost like you're at an oyster farm in Tomales Bay. Mm. Just a hint of seafood that some people might call fish. And then also if you smell down a little bit deeper, it smells like wonderfully warm bathwater that doesn't have any, I mean, in the best possible way, where you just, like, maybe you're at a spa or something and you're going to get into a nice warm tub and there's none of those nasty, you know, perfume things in the water. Really, it's very refreshing and almost a little bit like fog, which is one of the things that I find about pu'er that most attracts me, even though you drink it, I drink it hot. Almost at the core of it, there's this cooling quality that just reminds me of a foggy day near the coast. So anyway, there I go. Yeah. That's my take.
Interesting you should say that, because I really enjoy drinking the green pu'ers in the summertime when it's really hot. I find it a very cooling tea. Mm-hmm. Whereas the more oxidized ones, I like in the morning. I drink them almost every morning. But I chose these three teas because they're, in fact, very similar in the way they're produced. But they are very different, both in taste and aroma. Mm-hmm. And aroma is a big part of the enjoyment of tea in Asia. When we make tea, we tend to drink it for the taste or for the feel of the warmth going down. But in Asia, the aroma of tea is very much appreciated. In fact, so much that they actually have cups only for the purpose of enjoying the aroma. And from the aroma cups, then they pour them into the drinking cups.
Interesting.
So the first tea we took a look at was the bamboo fragrance pu'er. And let me just grab this tea. I'm particularly fond of these bamboo teas because they are absolutely traditional in very small ethnic areas of Yunnan, mostly in the southern province of Sichuanbana. They are very creative with how they produce these teas. And many of these are quite rare. They're hard to find. You actually have to go out there in the mountains and find some little village where they're making these teas. But they've been doing it this way for, you know, 1,000 years. And the first one we saw was a fairly small bamboo. It's about 1.5 inches in diameter. And the tea is picked green and then packed into these small sections of bamboo.
Yeah, they're about 1.25 inches across, it looks like.
In diameter. And then they're roasted over the fire to kill the enzymes and to slightly dry the tea out. And with this one, they scrape the bamboo after so it gives a nice clean appearance. The second one we tasted was from a larger section of bamboo. And it was about 5 inches across on the inside diameter. And this particular bamboo is, first of all, the bamboos are always picked green and must be fresh for the tea to work. And there's three different species of bamboo that they use for making tea. Each one will give the tea its own taste characteristic. So the second one is from a larger section of bamboo. And the tea itself was picked in the early spring, so you can see a lot of silver buds in there. And this particular tea I collected in 1998, so it's already going on 8 years. Mm-hmm. The third one is from Menghai, also in southern Yunnan province, and these are pressed into cakes. Each one is a green puer, but very different in taste and character. So now that we've rinsed the tea off, I'll add water to it, and you simply need to let it steep for a minute on the first infusion. All these teas you could re-steep many times, mm-hmm. and that's part of the fun of playing with these teas, is that you could take one little, you know, teaspoon of tea and re-steep that maybe up to a dozen times until the flavor is exhausted. And with each steep, you'll get a different taste characteristic from the tea. So if you like it strong, you can let it steep longer. If you want a light infusion, you just let it steep for about a minute.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll let you go ahead and finish making the tea. Les, how many times now have you all gone to China together?
Two times.
Two times. And who is it that you're gathering these teas from? Are they little farmers?
In many cases, I've seen him go into the streets where maybe 30 different farmers will surround him with little bags that contain maybe half a pound of tea, and they'll try to get him to smell it and buy it.
Really?
But then sometimes he'll go into a market and might find 5 or 6 tea sellers with large amounts of tea, and he might find it there. Mm-hmm. And he's got contacts over there who try to buy it for him, but he doesn't care for that. He likes to find it himself.
Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like your reputation in the tea growing areas, it sounds like they know you?
They know me over there, yeah.
And they want to sell their tea to you?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, because by default, I mean, there's no one else over there doing what I was doing, so they had put me on national television there at least half dozen times, and they got a big kick out of this foreigner coming and taking such a passionate interest in their tea. And even in China, no one has really gone off into the mountains to collect tea this way. The Chinese don't like to do that. They always buy from, you know, various series of middlemen, and eventually the teas will end up in the cities and towns, and they're purchased from tea brokers. But I like to go directly to the source whenever possible, because you could really have the best chance of finding exceptional teas.
Mm-hmm. How hard was it for you to get to, I mean, other than the police stopping you and that sort of thing, once you were able to get to the geographic region, what did it take for people to talk to you and to, you know, offer you their tea, that sort of thing?
Oh, that was easy. I mean, tea is offered automatically. Okay. Even if I wasn't a tea person, they would have offered me tea the first thing. That's what they do to welcome a guest, is you serve them tea. If you have a guest in your presence and you don't serve tea, they will get up and walk out thinking they are not welcome.
Oh, really? So it's that part that's that important
to
the culture.
Tea is very important in their culture. It's so much ingrained in their social connection with family and friends and visitors that you always welcome a guest with a cup of tea.
Mm-hmm. Is the tea all cultivated, or is some of it, is this particular plant, the camellia, does it also grow wild in that region?
It does grow wild, and that was part of my my interest in Yunnan province, is there are many ancient forests there where the tea is just grown indigenously. And these are wild plants. There's actually two types of wild plants in China. You have the wild plants that were not planted. They're simply growing out in the mountains. And then you have the tea plants that were at one time planted but have since been abandoned. And these are mostly found in remote areas of the mountains where the people just don't bother to go off and collect these teas anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, these really make very nice teas.
Now, you're doing some work with the Tea Research Institute, is that right?
Yes, I had started their organic tea program there years ago. This was my interest, was to have sources for pure organic teas, which all the teas in China up until about 50 years ago were all organic and sustainable.
Mm-hmm. And what's happening now? How has that changed?
The same thing is happening everywhere on the planet. The big chemical companies have come in and pushed their chemicals to supposedly make life easier and more profitable for the farmers. But the reality is, once they've tried these chemicals, it's very difficult for them to stop using them because the soil becomes very depleted from nutrients. So they're almost forced to continue to use chemicals if they want to get a harvest that they could sell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the small farmers often will grow without any chemicals at all. In fact, the wild teas, of course, are completely chemical-free. So what I was doing with the Research Institute was initiating a program to give incentive to the farmers to grow organically and sustainable and hopefully get a higher price on the open market for their product.
And how's the progress on that project?
It's mixed. Unfortunately, the politics of tea and the organic nature of tea has become more of a marketing concept rather than an actual process of farming. And the farmers understand what this is, but when the government and tea business people get involved, often they will use the term organic to help sell the tea, but in fact, the tea would not pass organic certification by our standards. But at the same time, you could find teas that are truly organic but are impossible to get certified because the cost involved in China is very expensive for someone to go through the organic certification process.
Mm-hmm. The teas that you're bringing in, are they in every category? Are you bringing in only organics?
Well, I'm bringing teas in for Silk Road teas as well. I continue to go to China. to help the new owner purchase all the teas for the year. And the teas that I bring in on the pu'ers, I like to think that they're all organic. Mm-hmm. And if I have any sense that they're growing them with chemicals or I could taste chemicals, then I simply don't buy the teas.
What are you going to say? You have 300 types of pu'er. What do you do with it?
Well, I store them. I have the first cave in America, the first pu'er cave.
You have a pu'er cave? Take us there.
It's underground. It keeps the humidity up and the temperature down. In order for tea to age well, there's two types of tea storage. One is storing tea to improve the taste of aging the tea, and the second method is to store the tea so it doesn't change. In mm-hmm. other words, if you already like where the tea is at and you want to keep it there, then you want to store it dry and cool so it doesn't change. But if you have a tea that you feel will improve by storing the tea or aging the tea, then you need to keep the humidity up. You need to allow the tea to breathe, but not too much so that you don't lose the aroma through too much air circulation. But you need enough so that the teas won't become moldy and undrinkable.
Mm-hmm. And so how much tea do you have in your cave?
I have, I think about 50,000 pounds, give or take a ton or two.
Uh-huh. And are you just keeping it there? Do you sell it?
I sell the tea off slowly. Some of the teas are not ready for sale. I'm simply aging them.
Uh-huh. It's almost like a cheese. It's like a cheese aging cave where you let someone else makes the cheese and then you age it and sort of shape it.
Yeah, yeah. And once you get the sense of what's going on with the tea, mm-hmm. it is easy to shape the taste according to what you're looking to get. Mm-hmm. You just have to be patient because the taste changes slowly. So, most of the teas I have here now are over 5 years old, and I have teas that go back to the 70s. But it takes about 4 to 5 years to get a green pu'er aged enough so that you lose that astringency, that bite that mm-hmm. is not so pleasant when mm-hmm. the tea is
Let's
fresh.
Let's talk about the black pu'ers, the ones that when you make them, they look like a cup of dark coffee,
yeah.
but are not astringent at all.
Yeah.
What is the process that plant has gone through to get to that point?
Well, there's two ways of getting that oxidation. One is, it's not fair to say artificial, but they use that word. They artificially age it by having high humidity and high temperature for a couple of weeks at a time to boost the oxidation process. The second type of oxidation is a much slower process where they do it over years. And that's the type that's more desirable.
Mm-hmm.
But the oxidation allows the tea to be much more forgiving in the steeping process. You could actually boil the tea overnight if you want, like the Tibetans do. And it's perfectly drinkable. I mean, it can be very delicious. So the mark of a good pu'er, at least for me, is if you've got a good quality pu'er, you could steep it really strong and it's still going to be very pleasant on the palate.
Very smooth.
Very
it's got
smooth.
That very smooth quality.
Yeah. And if you wanted to add milk to a tea, you could certainly do that with the oxidized pu'ers. I wouldn't recommend it with a green pu'er mm-hmm. somehow.
Yeah, green tea and milk just doesn't mm-hmm. seem to.
Yeah.
So you're gonna pour us some now. And the green tea results in sort of an amber color.
Yeah, it's
an amber
lighter.
Liquid, much lighter than
when,
the black.
When the teas were fresh, in other words, just a year or two old, they're very light green.
Mm-hmm.
But these are all aged now, so you get that amber color.
Mm-hmm.
That is the oxidation. And as I was talking, I got the first one poured off in time. I wasn't able to pour the first two. So these may not taste real pleasant because they're going to be strong now. But the beauty with tea is there's so much flavor locked up in the leaf. You could simply add hot water to the poured cup and do a second and third infusion mm-hmm. And get it to where you like it. Mm-hmm. So often a lot of the teas they serve in China, they make them very strong and keep them that way throughout the day. And then when you want a cup, you simply add water to it and dilute it down.
Mm. And you're making these, you have the three, what did you call?
Gaiwan.
Gaiwan, and then three little pitchers into which you poured the tea. And they're sitting on what I believe is a tea boat.
Uh-huh.
Is that right?
Very good.
And the way I've seen tea boats used is you pour out as much tea as you're going to drink, and then the excess in the little pot or whatever, you pour into the tea boat so that it doesn't get too strong. Is that something?
Yeah, the tea boat, or I call them preparation tables. Mm-hmm. Seems to be more what they're about. They're very useful in that you pour any liquid that you don't want it through the grill on top, and the liquid is kept inside the boat till you want to empty it. But this allows you to rinse the tea. If it's too strong for you when you make it, you could simply pour it out. Mm-hmm. The main thing to consider when making tea, though, is to use a small pot or cup when you make the tea. That way you could control the taste exactly where you want it. And that's part of the beauty of what they call gung fu style tea making in China, is you're using lots of leaf in a small pot and with very short infusions. And you could re-steep that up to, as I say, a dozen times mm-hmm. with many of the teas.
Mm-hmm. So the big English-style pot is another thing entirely, and that's not what we're talking about.
They're very problematic mm-hmm. to use for tea. Unless you're going for one infusion and you're using tea bags or something where the tea particle size is very small and they steep very quickly. But the beauty with full-leaf teas is they keep their freshness much longer. The flavor is locked up in the leaf, and they stay fresh much longer than they would if they were ground up in small pieces.
That's an interesting way to put it, because certainly everyone's had experience with a tea bag. And, you know, you make one cup and then, you know, you're in the diner at 2 in the morning driving somewhere, and that's the only thing you want. And the second time you get water, you know, it barely has any color. So it just gives everything up right away because it's so ground up.
Yeah, yeah. And full leaf teas actually are not complicated. Mm-hmm. They're as easy to use as any tea bag. And if you look at this teapot here that I've been using for 15 years, it's simply a clay pot out of what they call Yixing clay or purple clay. And you have some holes over this spout to restrain the tea leaf. So you simply put your tea leaf in there, put your water in, and let it steep and pour out when it's ready. It's absolutely foolproof to make. Mm-hmm. It's not complicated, but people like the convenience of a tea bag, but then you're sacrificing a lot of the flavor and aroma with a tea bag.
Yeah, so couldn't we try it?
Sure.
I'm sitting here dying. Yeah, it looks really good. I can't wait to try some. What did I want to ask you? When you were filming over in China, what were some of the things you found most interesting in relationship to the tea? Anything surprise you?
Well, it was all a new adventure, my first trip over especially,
mm-hmm.
to see rolling hills or steep hills with the tea all growing there, and the smells in the warehouses where they would bring the tea, and they would heat the tea to continue the drying out process, and it made this delicious aroma that I could just live in there forever and mm-hmm. smell that tea. The food, I must admit, was astoundingly good. Every lunchtime and every dinner time, we had these incredible feasts and never ate the same thing twice. It was always something new, some new kind of live creature or a new kind of plant and cooked in a delicious way. Never had one single dish that was disappointing.
And a lot of things you hadn't eaten before?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And will some of that make it into the film? Some of the foods?
Hopefully, but it's not the main focus.
And where are you? Where is the film in sort of its lifespan? How long before we get to see it?
Well, it's getting close. We showed a work in progress in Washington at the Environmental Film Festival, and they're happy with the way it's going. And they booked it again in March in D.C. in the National Geographic Theater, March 24th, actually. Whether it's ready or not, they're agreed to bill it as a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping to have it all finished in time for the Telluride Festival in September.
One thing we haven't talked about, and I think it would be interesting, is what do puer teas cost?
What do they cost?
Yeah, what do they cost? I mean, are they incredibly expensive?
They're incredibly inexpensive. Typically, what people don't realize, when you go into your local supermarket and you're buying a box of tea bags, if you look at the price you're paying for tea bags and the amount of weight that you're getting, it's usually about 1 ounce of tea, and you look on the box, or 1.1 mm-hmm. ounce. And if you price that out by the pound, you're paying $40, $50, even up to $150 a pound for common tea bags. Well, none of these puers will cost that much unless you get a really rare aged tea.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these teas cost less than what you would pay for common tea bags in the supermarket. And if you figure you could re-steep these teas many times, then it makes them very, very affordable.
When you go out shopping for puer, the average person, I don't mean you, David, how do you know what you're getting? Are there certain questions you could ask? I was at a tea store in Chinatown, and, you know, I asked, how old is this? And I could tell from the look on her face, she sat there thinking about it. She said, 20 years. Yeah. It's like she had no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm curious, what should somebody who wants to discover puer know when they're going shopping for it?
Well, the first thing I would suggest is try and taste the tea before you commit to a purchase, because very often you'll see, you know, a block of tea or a cake of tea all wrapped up with lots of fancy awards associated with it and a big price tag and claims that it's really old and precious. And I went through that period where I would buy all these teas and try them out. It's very hard to find a good tea in that venue. It's you're really better off to taste the teas. Go with someone who knows teas. Go to the dim sum restaurants and get your start there with a puer tea or bole cha. And the more you taste, the more you'll realize what you like and what you dislike about tea. But it's such a big topic that I find the more I study puer teas, the more I realize how little I know about the subject, is because it is so great.
And you know more than anyone I've ever met on the subject. And I should say that here in Sonoma County, you can go to Infusions in Sebastopol. They've opened up sort of a second location at the Kids Spot on Highway 12 in Sebastopol, where they have a little tea cart and you can go in and get a cup of tea. But in Infusions, Mickey has, at any one time, maybe five different kinds of puer available, and you can always sample teas there. She makes you cups. And on that note, we are nearly out of time, but Les, before we say goodbye to both of you, do you have any showings coming up, any way for people to see your films other than going to the website and buying them?
Not in the area. I just had one at the San Francisco Public Library.
Mm-hmm. But we always will let you know if there's going to be any showings around Sonoma County.
Mark and Ann will be on PBS on the POV show. But I think that's in the summer.
Uh-huh. Coming up in the summer. Okay. Yeah. And so maybe sometime within the next year we'll see the tea movie?
I hope so.
Maybe we can do something to help out with a screening here in Sonoma County.
Yeah.
On that note, I want to say, David Hoffman, thank you so much for all that you've done for the show and for bringing so many beautiful things to look at. And Les, thank you so much for coming up to Mouthful yet again. I can't wait to welcome you back. We're going to leave you with some very wise advice from Les's film, Yum, Yum, Yum.
I'd eat my grandma's cooking. I'd eat the gumballs and the sauce pecan she'd make in the pies. And I'd look at that, and I loved that stuff. I'd look at my father the way he'd make a gumbo or a sauce piquant, and it was almost just like his mother was, because he loved it also, and I loved it. But it looks like when somebody doesn't really give a damn about something, well, listen, I think I'm going to add a little bit of this, maybe, that was never been done before, or I'm going to add a little bit of this, or I'm going to put this note here instead. And I'm not against anything changing, you know, because I think the natural process, the natural way just of living and dying changes things enough. But when you really love something, whether it's cooking a bowl of gumbo or a pot full of sauce piquant or playing a pretty two-step or waltz, if you really love it, you're going to try to do it just like the person you heard it or tasted it. You'll do it just like it. To me, when you really love something for what it is, you leave it alone.